Hello and welcome to edition 380 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck.
And me, Tom Edwards.
On today's show, we'll be joined by American political analyst, cultural historian and journalist, Thomas Frank. He'll be discussing his new book, Listen Liberal, and telling us why Hillary Clinton and the Democrats still have much to do in the race for the White House.
We'll also be hearing from astronomers Radmila Topalovich and Tom Kerrs. Their new book, Stargazing, aims to explain the basics of the cosmos. We'll try and establish whether it really all revolves around Monocle's Robert Bound.
And we'll be getting a crash course in the Francophile culture from someone who had to learn pretty quickly herself, the writer and journalist Lauren Collins. Her new book, When in French, details why overcoming the language barrier for her became a labour of love.
All that to come. Plus, Daniel Giacopelli will be trying to speak some sense too. He'll do his best in the news look ahead, and we'll enjoy some great music. That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Andrew, another week bites the dust. And can I just say that when you said edition 380 coming up, you said it a little bit like the announcer at the darts calling out 180. That's what it reminded me of.
380.
See, exactly like that.
Boom. Bullseye. And,
bullseye.
What are we going to do for 400?
Well, who knows? I'm sure our producer Tom Hall has some few plans up his sleeve.
A little cake being baked.
Oh, he better be. Is he the home cooking type?
No, I don't think he's.
No, he's shaking his head.
I don't think he's a home baker. Did you have a good week? Well,
yeah,
you had a couple of days off.
A couple of days off.
I feel
kind of rested and revitalised. Do you?
Well, that's good.
You're looking well, Andrew, this Sunday lunchtime.
Yeah, I'm feeling good. I feel. You know when you're at the top of the toboggan run,
okay,
and it's like downhill all the way to Christmas. I think there are some twists and turns to get to December 24th, which is my birthday. Put the presents in the post.
A crest to run.
Yeah,
of
I think
chaos
a crest to run of chaos ahead. Including
it's a busy time. It's good, isn't it?
One little kind of mogul of hardened ice in the road, and that would be Daniel Giacopelli.
Daddy, there's no other but Daddy.
Daniel Giacopelli, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Oh, Tom, it is always a pleasure.
sitting
across from you.
Of insincerity. What's got you excited about the week ahead, Danny?
Well, I probably shouldn't start on serious news. It'd be a bit bad.
No, you can do serious.
Okay, well, I'm not really excited about this, but the jungle in Calais is going to be dismantled starting next week on the 17th. So there's about 7,000 to 10,000 migrants living there for the past who knows how many months. And Francois Hollande is committed now to basically closing it down. On the 17th, it's going to begin.
And have they said where the people will actually go to?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a sad...
Well, no, I believe, but they're trying to rehome some of the, especially some of the young residents, because there's a huge number of...
Children, unaccompanied children.
And they're trying
to... We saw that story last week with the Home Office here in the UK turned away kind of thousands of
which is
of
appalling,
them.
But there's moves afoot, I think, still, despite that, to try and get some of these poor, hapless kids.
Yeah, there's a few thousand unaccompanied kids.
So yeah. Let's hope that happens.
Okay, that cheered us
up.
That
was pretty...
Next.
Grim.
What else could I talk about? The Frankfurt Book Fair is next week. We're going to be there, of course.
Yes, we are.
Who's going to be there? You?
I'm going.
Tom?
I'm holding the fort, but Monocle 24, will it ever be there? All sorts.
Yeah, Monocle 24 will be there. We've got our new food and drink book out. We have a very nice stand at the Messer, and we'll be broadcasting. We'll have a pop-up shop. We're going to do coffee. We're going to have a hokey-cokey at the end of each day.
If people are strolling around the Buchmesse, they will find other... We'll have some M24 roving reporters, Danny, there as well.
It's a pretty amazing event.
Yeah.
The Marcus Hippie, yeah.
Marcus Hippie
who
himself.
Speaks a couple of languages, which is something we're going to be talking about later in the programme.
Yes.
Multilinguicity.
Finnish, Wookiee, German, English.
Wookiee?
Yeah. That's one of the things he speaks.
Okay. Right, let's move on.
The Chewbacca language. What else, Danny?
What else? I didn't know this exists, but it does. On the 20th, it's called the Great Shakeout, the Global Great Shakeout Earthquake Drill. Basically, 20 million people around the world practice what happens when an earthquake hits. And every country has their own kind of way of doing it, but generally, it's a massive amount of people going under their desks and thinking about
under their desks
where the nearest exit is. Yeah.
I think
if you're at school. Or...
I think Jamie Waters, who sits next to me, he's been practicing for months. Often I said, where is he? He's like having a little curl up light. No, this doesn't. But he does seem to get very tangled in his wires. He's often underneath the desk trying to sort wires.
There's an astonishing amount of people doing it. I mean, California has 10 million people signed up. Japan, 4.7 million.
Why do they have to do it at the same time, Danny?
It's kind of fun. It's like, you know.
Is that fun?
I haven't been. Have you ever been in an earthquake?
I haven't. I don't think they have them in this country, really, do they? We're not on
but lots of the...
We're not jinxed
us. We're not on a plate.
Obviously, lots
What's
of
that moving? It's a shaking in the room.
Lots of our team who are in Tokyo, they've often been through... Well, they've been through many earthquakes. Mm. And an interesting, when you go to our office, all of the pictures are framed with plastic instead of glass. Because in Tokyo, you don't put glass in picture frames. Because
they fall off so
regularly.
So readily, yeah.
And smash on the floor, that you have kind of like a fiberglass glass that doesn't smash.
That is interesting.
Pub
it?
Trivia question there.
That's a good one.
That's good.
What else? The Bloomsbury Festival is happening in London next week.
My neighbourhood.
Your hood. I was going to say it. I don't know if you wanted to publicize it to the world.
Very good neighbourhood.
What goes on there?
It's all kinds of free events. The museums and galleries all have people in. Parks, gardens. An eclectic range of exhibitions, it says here. Not that I'm reading from anything.
They take over the local parks. There's a bit of a kind of festivities.
It looks
alcohol
fun.
Alcohol involved.
Nice.
It's also Diwali next week. How do you say
Festival of Light. Diwali, yes.
The Festival of Light. What else? This is a bit of an odd one. The International Whaling Commission, they're having their biennial meeting, but it's in Slovenia, of all places, where there are no whales, as far as I'm aware.
Well, there's probably whales.
There's probably a very good reason.
The Adriatic whales? Okay.
Yeah. And Danny, of course, later in the show, we're going to be talking to Thomas Frank about the state of
the nation.
The left and sort of liberal America, but also generally... about the race for the White House. And there's potentially another big day coming up in the next 7 days.
Yeah, the third and final Touchwood presidential debate between Trump and Hillary. And thank God it's almost over. That's all I could say.
A few weeks to go yet.
I don't even care who wins anymore. I just want nightmare to be over.
We'll wait and see. You can't trust anything these days. But Danny, we can trust you. Thank you for coming to see us.
Thanks.
Well, it's been another turbulent week in US politics. Wednesday, we'll see Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump go head-to-head once more in the final presidential debate.
But Hillary, largely considered the more sane, experienced and less orange of the two, has more than just those attending at the University of Nevada to convince. In his new book, Listen Liberal, US social critic Thomas Frank argues that the Democrats have largely abandoned the party's traditional commitments to the working class, according to Frank. They're so busy holidaying in Martha's Vineyard and attending interesting TED Talks that they've forgotten to focus on the real issues at stake. And, well, he joins us now to talk all about it. Thomas Frank, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Well, hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Listen, we talk a lot recently about a crisis, I guess, in the political classes, whether it be in Europe, certainly here in the UK or in the United States.
You use that term, the political class?
I've used it.
Okay.
But I wonder, how much of the problem do you think in the US is within the Democrat side? Because it's easy and understandable, I guess, given recent events, to look to the Republicans and see the GOP in a mess. But I guess in the book, and more broadly, if we look at the left, there's some pretty kind of unconvincing manoeuvres by some of the most senior people, aren't there?
Well, look, I've written a bunch of books in my life, and I wrote three books about conservatism in America, which fascinated me for years, and I have sort of exhausted that topic. I think that's the way to put it. We're living in a conservative era, and the conservatives are in America, the Republicans are responsible for a lot of the disasters that have overtaken ordinary people, from the decline of organized labor to the sort of deindustrialization of their country. And I know that, you know, about the dedication to markets and what that has done. I'm fully aware of that. But any explanation of what's happened in America that ignores the role of the Democrats is missing the picture. And I think missing like a really, really, really essential part of the picture. First fact to remember is that our current president is a Democrat, and not just a Democrat, but was widely regarded as being the most liberal of all possible Democrats. In fact, the Republicans will call him a communist from time to time. And it's also important to remember that the last Democratic president, Bill Clinton, was the one who really sort of achieved the Reagan Revolution. It wasn't Ronald Reagan that got, you know, so many of the things that we associate with conservatism. It wasn't Reagan that got them done. It was Clinton. And in some cases, it was even Jimmy Carter. Reagan's Democratic predecessor. And so to understand the political universe in America, common sense way of understanding it is you have a party of the left and you have a party of the right, and they're at loggerheads and they fight and fight and fight, and one party takes us one direction and the other party takes us the other, and it's not like that at all. It's a little more complicated, and it's been the Democrats who have, in a lot of cases, consummated the market revolution in America.
You know, here in the UK, there was a feeling that, you know, London voted to remain within the European Union, the rest of the country decided to leave. And one of the feelings was, and that you can find echoes of this all across Europe, the feeling was that the city, the heart, the capital, was living in a different way to the rest of the country. And here, you know, the liberal ideal had worked out. We were multicultural, we were metropolitan, we had lots of things that kind of showed you to be a sparkly, nice city. Is that the same problem in America, that the Democrats are living in a world where, yeah, they live in Washington, D.C. or New York, they live in nice metropolitan cities on the East and West Coast, and many of the people in power have forgotten what it's like to be outside of those cities, to live in a place where there is actually quite grinding poverty?
I live in Washington, D.C., or in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and it's exactly as you just described. And they're very, you know, it's a very prosperous city. So it's, I believe, the richest city in America. It's either Washington or San Francisco. It's always neck and neck. It's very prosperous, very affluent. And the people that I live among in my neighborhood are very pleased with themselves and very liberal. They're Democrats. And they congratulate themselves. They understand that their wealth is something that they deserve because they are tolerant people. And they understand other cultures, and they're the opposite of racist, and they are very well educated people. And so they see, for them, the whole world, the sort of, you know, globalist world that we're living in makes a lot of sense. Now, you know, most people in the UK, when they visit the United States, they stay on the East Coast. They might go to Washington. They might go to New York. But listen, folks, next time you take the train from one city to the other, look out the window. Okay? It is a shocking sight. I mean, this is America, the great industrial powerhouse of the world, is falling apart. Once you're outside of the great glittering cities, New York is also in this sort of, it's in this period of amazing prosperity. You know, nobody can afford to live in Manhattan. Even Brooklyn is out of most people's range anymore. And the same with San Francisco, Seattle, you know, Los Angeles, stuff like that. But if you went to Cleveland for the Republican convention, for example, it's like, you know, this is a place that's glory days are 50 years behind them. Places that hitched their wagon to industry and manufacturing, or basically anything other than the sort of post-industrial economy, these places are hurting. You know, we had a financial crisis and a recession in America, and we gave it to you. You caught it from us.
Yes.
And that was our genius invention. And we recovered from it very quickly. You know this. The stock market in America is doing really well these days. The Obama years have been fantastic for people at the top 10% of the income distribution. I mean, amazing times. And but for Americans who aren't part of that, the recovery never came. They do these polls, opinion polls in America all the time, where they ask people about whether or not the recovery has come. And they say, no, we're still in a recession. And this is factually incorrect. Technically, the recession ended in 2009. A majority of Americans to this day still think it's going on. That's because for them, it is.
But Thomas, when you've got that kind of cloud over so many people, you also write in the book, and I know you've written before, about a failure to kind of grasp an opportunity here. And looking particularly at the Democratic Party, saying, look, there was an opportunity to try and return to some key values, to look after these core demographics, maybe the people whose voices weren't heard. But I guess some of the people maybe in frontline politics will say, well, look, you know, at the same time, if we acknowledge the struggles that so many people have, the failure of, like, you know, heavy industry in a lot of ways, maybe there's a case for them saying, look, we're trying to do what's politically expedient, which is understandable. And actually, it isn't so easy. This isn't a missed opportunity. We've just been doing our best. And 90% of the country is struggling.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not our fault. What would you say to people who said that? I mean, are there people in the political class who voice that view?
Oh, of course. Well, I would say that's the standard view among the political. I love that term, by the way, the political class.
I'm going to keep saying it.
I love it. But that's the standard view, but with one more sort of turn of the screw, which is they'd say, Obama couldn't have done anything differently. Not only did he do his best, but he did everything he possibly could, and he couldn't have gone any farther because the Republicans wouldn't let him. It's a kind of fatalism. We are in the grip of forces beyond our control, including the global economy, including the Republican Party, which is sometimes regarded as a force of nature in America, you know, or as a malevolent force of, you know, two brothers in Wichita, Kansas, who happen to have a lot, billions and billions of dollars. But basically, the tendency is to get Obama and the Democrats off the hook. And so I go to, I think, some great lengths in Listen Liberal, but I think appropriate lengths to show that that's not the case, that there are things that Obama could have done differently. And of course, there are things that Bill Clinton could have done differently. But what you remember when Obama first was swept into office in 2008, and this man was beloved, right? And he had, you know, there was, what, 2 million people at his inauguration? He would do these rallies where 75,000 people would show. It was extraordinary what was going on with this guy. He was a hero. I was a great fan of his at the time. And my own personal feeling is that this man was, you know, this was the Franklin Roosevelt of my generation. That this was the hero. This is the man that is going to put things right. He knows what's gone wrong. And he did say, you know, he had did these great speeches about Wall Street and what it was doing to the economy. We put him into office. He had both houses of Congress behind him. And he continued basically the Bush administration policies on, at least on Wall Street, essentially unchanged for the first 2 years of his administration. It's the most extraordinary thing. He brought in.
But are you saying that's because he was essentially, you know, for simplistic language, saying he wasn't the right man for the job? Or are you saying the machine wasn't against him? Are you saying he could have done?
Well, we don't.
He could have made an effective New Deal for America at that time, if he'd wanted
to. I think he could have. I think that lots of things were in his power and he chose not to. And it's important to remember that the man had agency. He's the president of the United States, for God's sake. The right wingers have a phrase in America, personnel is policy. And I remember when Obama came in, I'll tell you a kind of a sad, pathetic anecdote about me. One of the reasons I was so enthusiastic about Barack Obama, I've never really liked the Clintons, and I thought this guy will break the grip of Clintonism on the Democratic Party. He'll bring in all new people. You know, it'll be great. And he turns around and brings in as his right-hand man on economic matters, which is to say the most important thing facing the country, Larry Summers, who had been Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary and who had been this big fan of deregulation and had, in fact, engineered the deregulation of Wall Street. And then he brought in a whole, it was all the Clinton retreads, you know, Eric Holder, his attorney general. There was a whole raft of them. It was all the, I mean, Hillary, well, the Secretary of State.
Is that an ideological decision? Or do you think people are small c conservative when they actually get into the Oval Office? But why would he not have grasped the nettle? Or are you saying, is it a personal failure, maybe a lack of ambition or conviction even?
I think that's for Obama to explain. And I'm sure he, when he writes his next book of memoirs, he's got two of them already. And they're one of them is pretty good. When he writes the next one, he will tell us. We don't really know. I assume the assumption that I go on in Listen Liberal is that it was out of a sort of misguided reverence for expertise and for a certain kind of expertise, which is to say academic expertise, particularly Harvard, you know, stamped on both sides, Harvard approved expertise. And that what we have seen in the Obama years is in some ways a kind of meritocracy of failure. It's the folly of expertise. And we've seen this before in American history. The Vietnam War is a classic example. You guys familiar with this? There's a famous book written in the 70s called The Best and the Brightest. And it was about how these Harvard political scientists and international relations experts, you know, people like Henry Kissinger, you know, dreamed up the Vietnam War. It was their baby and kept it going, you know, even against massive protest. And even at the beginning, plenty of people could see this was a mistake. But they're like, no, the experts, you know, and the experts are the ones in charge and we know what's best. And, you know, and they led us down that path. And it was a terrible disaster. And you sort of see the same kind of thing happening again with Obama.
And just tell me, you know, cut to today for, as a believer in liberal values and in a believer in that liberal dream, to see that revived and reconnect with ordinary voters, what would it take? I think, you know, you were one of the people who felt that Bernie Sanders was potentially somebody who could have carried through that mission. Again, if he was the savior, why didn't he make it?
the Democratic machine was really against this guy. But what, I mean, among other lessons that we are learning this year here in 2016 is we've never had a better demonstration of the failings of the two-party system in America, which the two-party system in my country is essentially inscribed in law. There's no way out of it. And if one of the two parties is well organized enough to just be able to dictate, this is our candidate, it's going to happen. And that's what happened in the case of the Democrats, that, you know, Clinton was the candidate of the party machinery. Every, you know, elected official in the Democratic Party was behind her. We now know the Democratic National Committee supported her over Sanders, even though they're supposed to be impartial. We know that Barack Obama did everything in his power to make sure that she was a candidate, including talking Joe Biden, his vice president, talking Biden out of running. Biden would have made a, you know, strong challenger and would certainly be, well, there's no question now but that Clinton is going to win the election. You know, there's no doubt in my mind, but Biden would have never even been, Trump would have never even gotten close. I mean, Biden would have crushed him. But, you know, and Sanders as well.
I want to ask one small, almost final question. I'm sure Tom would want to dive back in. What have you got against bike lanes? I understand that this is a...
I ride a scooter. I ride on the bike lanes. Maybe I'm not supposed to ride the scooter in the bike lanes. But, you know, the bike lanes are sort of part of a program for municipal revival that Democrats have signed on to all over America. It's something like you see it in London all the time. You see it in Washington all the time. And you actually see people riding in the bike lanes, and it makes a certain amount of sense. It's a popular hobby in these places, but it's a class-based thing. It's people who, you know. And then you also see it in places where it just has, where nobody rides in them, where there's nobody on the bike lanes, you know. And they've just been constructed because out of sort of loyalty to this model that, like, if you do things for yuppies, the yuppies will show up. If you build facilities for the yuppies, like a birdhouse, if you put a birdhouse in your yard, the birds will just move right in. And so this is the kind of idea. And it's also sort of like, you know what a cargo cult is? This thing after World War II, where people be like, well, if we build, you know, this something that looks like an airplane, the airplanes will come back, you know, will bring us stuff. And it's like you've got cities all over America, these sort of ruined industrial, you know, former industrial cities all over America that are trying to make themselves, and the word they actually use this word, trying to make themselves cool. under the misguided assumption that if they do that, then the cool people will show up and prosperity will return, you know? So it's like, you know, they go around in sunglasses and they subsidize indie rock bands. And it's like, it is hilarious. I mean, it's not hilarious. It's tragic. It's pathetic.
It's showy urbanism from City Hall that doesn't actually create jobs. Yeah.
It doesn't do anything, but it's cheap also. You got to remember this is a cheap program for urban revival. And these are cities, by the way, that are very desperate. And in a lot of cases, they have they've followed every trend in municipal planning. Like they've built the giant convention centers. 20 years ago, there was this arms race to build the largest convention center all over the Midwest. Like that's going to save your city. And then there was gambling. And the idea was if we can just get casinos into our city. And there are these endless wars over sports teams. Compared to those things, this is pretty benign, like building bike lanes, you know? So in that sense, you know, it's a nice thing, but no, it's kind of pathetic.
I think that brings down the curtain just perfectly, I think. Thomas Frank is the author of Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, which is out now, published by Scribe. Thomas, thanks for coming to tell us all about it.
It was my pleasure, guys.
Andrew, I think it's time for a tune or two. What say you? Bit of music?
I'd love a little tune. What are you going to play for me this week?
Well, at the end of the show, we'll be hearing from writer Lauren Collins about the ins and outs of French culture and language. So let's hear a fine example of it. It's Jacques Dutronc with Et moi, et moi, et moi.
700 millions de Chinois. Et moi, et moi, et moi. Avec ma vie, mon petit schéma. Mon mal de tête, mon poids au foie, j'y pense et puis j'oublie. C'est la vie, c'est la vie. 80 millions d'Indonésiens, et moi, et moi, et moi.
Well, that was the very fine sound of Jacques Dutronc with Et moi, et moi, et moi.
Ha ha!
We're off to outer space now, and the people taking us there are Radmila Topalovic and Tom Kurz. Radmila is Astronomy Programmes Officer at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, and she holds a PhD in space dust. And Tom is Lead Astronomy Education Officer at the same establishment. The duo's new book, Stargazing, A Beginner's Guide to Astronomy, aims to open up the heavens a little more to newcomers. And they sat down with Monocle's Robert Bound a little earlier to give him a crash course.
Thank you both for coming in. Thank you for taking your eye away from your telescopes for a split second to join us on the Monocle Weekly. First things first, we're experiencing cold, clear, nice evenings at the moment. And I wonder whether the winter and this kind of cooler air actually is conversely in your line of business, brings people out and brings the starry skies alive in a way that maybe the summer nights don't seem to. It's the cold clearness maybe
that attracts us. Well, we do. I mean, we're lucky that we do experience seasons here up in London.
Yeah.
And of course, the days are getting shorter. So, you know, the sun is setting earlier and earlier as we head towards the December solstice, the winter solstice around the 22nd of December. And so that's a great time to get out there and have a look, you know, look up. And it is a huge part of your natural landscape. And I think everybody kind of does it anyway without really consciously realising it. So, yeah, we really encourage everybody as we approach the winter to enjoy the night sky as much as you can.
It's a good time to get started because the nights are not too cold yet. You'll really test your mettle in the wintertime, of course. And there's this furious debate in the stargazing community about which is the best season to do stargazing. And I think, personally, I think the winter stars are the most beautiful. So the stars that are beginning to emerge now are the ones that you can cut your teeth on, and you can just explore such a variety of objects in the wintertime.
What would I need on my first trip out stargazing? What do I need to take?
Just you. A warm coat.
So I don't need any lenses, anything to...
For your first trip, you just take yourselves out, take your whole family out and just get comfortable with where you are, navigation and that kind of thing. There are so many star apps out there for your mobile, for your iPad, for your computer, you know, that you can use to help you to plan your evening. And that's what it's all about. It's planning.
When we were asked to write a book, one of the things we were really careful about is trying to manage people's expectations. There are a lot of false expectations about how the sky looks, and we're greeted to these beautiful pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope and the world's largest observatories, and they give us a somewhat false impression of what we as stargazers will see. And so we try not to encourage people to go out and use a huge telescope on their first session. It's very disorientating to zoom in, to narrow down a tiny part of the sky. You'll get lost very quickly. So when you're getting started, you really want to be looking at the widest possible view, seeing the tapestry of constellations across the sky and beginning to pick them out and figure out how they change across the year and how they move from one night to the next, gradually shifting throughout the year. And then learning your sense of direction, whichever hemisphere you're in, learning to find north or south. Mm. And then from there, sort of jumping around the sky, star hopping around the sky from one bright patch of the sky to another bright patch of the sky. It's only once you begin to build an understanding of how the sky takes shape over your head that you can then zoom in and see more detail. And if you do it in this order, in my opinion, it's much more rewarding because you sort of unlock things as you progress, but also it's much easier.
Mm. If I blindfolded you and drove you out into the middle of the countryside, would you know kind of where you are? Would you know which way to walk to...
If you took my blindfold off, this is something I
presumed
do.
A lot of knowledge on your behalf that you would, A, get into a car with me in the first place for the rest of it.
That'd be some amazing magnetic sensing skill that we have. I love doing country walks. I go out with a group of friends and I head out of London and go, and not too far, out into Kent, and we go on a country walk, and I love showing off a little bit by going, oh, that's north, and, you know, they've got their maps in front of them. It's so easy to find north. We do it in the planetarium all the time. Everybody can find north.
Yeah.
You look for a saucepan shape in the sky, and two of those stars point to the North Star, and then if you draw a vertical line down, you're essentially facing north. It's as easy as that. Something that I encourage actually youngsters to do is to beat their parents with, you know, their Google Maps on their phones. Try and find it faster than, you know, an online app. And they can do it. It's just really, as soon as you've done it a couple of times, it's really easy to find the plough.
I think anything that's quicker than a smartphone is a great selling point, right, at the moment.
I mean, it's amazing when you think about the history of the night sky and how it's aided in navigation. About 6 years ago or so, I spent quite a long time living in the Namib Desert in Namibia, just looking at the southern stars, which was something that fortunately, with that experience, I was able to bring to this book so that people in the Southern Hemisphere can make use of it too. And the stars down there are very much connected to the story of navigation. We're talking about people like Magellan, who sailed through the Southern Oceans and charted the sky with his colleagues. And that story is something that's very important in the history of astronomy and is celebrated by astronomers. So it's possible to find navigational stars across the sky that are actually of great historical importance that you can still use today. And as Rad Miller has said, you can begin with the most simple method of finding north here in the Northern Hemisphere. And then when you go on a trip to the Southern Hemisphere, you can try the more challenging method of finding true south. Yeah. And then from there, you can jump around the whole sky.
Is there anything in the Southern Hemisphere, let's just say up until Christmas, that you would recommend people if they were going to have a first session out stargazing, Tom, that you could point them towards?
So going through into Christmas time, the Magellanic clouds in the Southern Hemisphere are going to be rising higher and higher. They actually come into the best possible view around this time of year, and they're pretty much visible throughout the evening sky as we go through to what we would call the spring in the Northern Hemisphere.
And these are clouds of stars, these are constellations.
Yes, these are actually
get out there and see the clouds, they're great.
Great clouds. Two clouds in the sky that you can see on a clear night, very strange. They're actually dwarf galaxies that are bound to the Milky Way. So we live inside a large spiral type galaxy. All the stars that we see in the sky belong to our galaxy, and actually most of them are found in a very local part of our galaxy. The rest of our galaxy beyond appears as a cloud of light, once believed to be milk splashed onto the sky by the gods, and it's inherited the name Milky Way as a result. But now we know the Milky Way is billions and billions of stars just assembled into this huge flat disk of matter. However, the Milky Way is so large it can actually bring around 30 dwarf galaxies into orbit around it, and two of them are very prominent, the Magellanic Clouds. These are an absolute treat for anyone in the Southern Hemisphere, not something that we in the Northern Hemisphere are familiar with at all from experience, because we never see them, and they are actually attached to, again, that explorer Magellan, hence the name. These are coming into view, and they will be in a very, very good position, very easy to go and look for, but they are still relatively low in the south, unless you yourself are very far south, say on the southern tip of South Africa, or perhaps if you're really lucky down in Australia, somewhere like that, where you'll get a really clear view. But there's something we can all enjoy, actually, that is quite topical as we go through into the latter part of this month, around the 20th to the 25th of October, we experience the annual Orionids meteor shower. And the great thing about that is they radiate out from the constellation of Orion, which is a constellation that everybody in the world can see because it's in the what we call the equatorial region. It's the part of the sky that we share with our friends in the Southern Hemisphere. And the nice thing
good
about
hedging
Orionids,
your bets answer there, I like.
Yes, yeah. The nice thing about them, though, the thing that Rad and I really like about them is that they actually originate from Halley's Comet. And Edmund Halley was a great character from the Royal Observatory Greenwich. He had a very important role to play and is actually recognised as being the first scientist to understand the nature of comets properly. So from Halley's Comet, we get tiny fragments which burn up in our atmosphere, sort of 60 to 80 miles above your head, creating what we colloquially call shooting stars, don't we? These are actually meteors. These are tiny fragments of ice and dust burning up at incredible speed. Very serene, very beautiful, very safe.
Very beautiful,
as well.
Yeah.
So recommend going and taking a look at that in the latter part of October. And you can see that wherever you are in the world. So that's something we can all share together.
Nice. And Redmiller, that's quite a tough act to follow, isn't it? What's poor old Northern Hemisphere? What can we look forward to before Christmas up in the skies?
I love the winter in the Northern Hemisphere. Yeah. I don't want to influence other people's opinions, but my favourite constellation is Orion. It's so easy to find, and it's one of the rare constellations that actually looks like the mythological being it's supposed to represent, which is a Greek hunter. There are so many objects around Orion that you can see just with the naked eye, but also with binoculars and a telescope as well. You're spoilt for choice, but a couple of things that you should look out for is, first of all, in the right armpit of Orion, we've got the star Betelgeuse or Betelgeuse, and this star looks like an orangey-red colour in the sky, so straight away you can see it's a different colour to a lot of the other stars. This star is absolutely huge. If you were to swap the sun for Betelgeuse, the first four planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth and Mars, would be inside this star.
Whoa.
That's how huge this star is. And it is a dying star, so it's run out of its
fuel. Imagine what his armpit must feel like.
I know.
It won't be there forever.
He's got decent deodorant. I mean, he's hot.
Wait till you hear what's going to happen next. Okay. I mean, eventually this star will explode. And so we'll see a very, very bright star in the sky. It'll be really, really bright. You won't miss it. And that's called a supernova explosion. We're not entirely sure when that's going to happen. It's really hard to pin down an exact date. It could happen tomorrow. Might not happen for the next 1,000 years. But it is something to look forward to. And then eventually it'll fizzle away. You'll get a very, very faint cloud. That'll be the aftermath of that explosion. and you won't be able to see it with the naked eye anymore. So that part of Orion will just disappear
forever.
We have
to keep our eye on that while we can.
Keep an eye, yeah, watch okay. it while you can. Absolutely.
A watching brief. While we're on the subject, before we go, I mean, your book is called A Beginner's Guide to Stargazing. How did you both start? What was there? There's always some moment mm-hmm. where you it just clicks for people. I mean, you're astrophysicists. Yeah. I mean, there's obviously there is a big gap between being a kid and looking up at the sky and sure. being full of wonder and doing that. Or is there? I wonder, Radmila.
Yeah. Well, it started for me like back in the 80s. I watched a programme called Button Moon, which was a very cheaply
yes.
made.
I
programme.
Love it. Mr. Spoon.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I think that was my earliest kind of link to, you know, astronomy. And it's something that I used to watch with my dad as well. And he'd always point to the moon in the sky when I was little. And so I think it just stuck with me. You know, where did that come from? Where did all the stars come from? What's beyond that? You know, and it's a very philosophical question that I think humans, particularly children, are really good at doing, is asking those questions. You know, why is it all there? What's beyond it? You know, and that's something that we get asked quite a lot. You know, people come up to us and go, yeah. you know, sometimes it's quite terrifying to think about. But we want it to be a nice, pleasant, kind of comforting experience as well. We are surrounded by stars. Most of those stars have got planets. So we're surrounded by solar systems, hundreds of billions of them in our galaxy. And are we alone? I don't think we are. I don't think we are alone. I think that there is an intelligent race on a planet, probably many millions of light years away, probably in a whole different galaxy somewhere else. And they're asking the same questions that we are, you know. Whether we'll ever contact them, who knows? But it's just comforting, I think, to think that they might actually be there doing what we do here on our, in our daily lives.
I love that answer.
I think we have to give a shout out to dads, don't we? Because I had the same
yeah.
experience. My father is a pilot today. He flies for British Airways, but before that he was in the Royal Air Force for about 20 years. And what inspired him to go into flying was basically watching people stand on the moon when he was a boy. Mm. So he watched that live on TV and he couldn't believe it. Was incredible, you know, to a boy at age 10 or 11 years old to see that. So when he eventually became a pilot and then later I was born, he raised me with a huge interest in things like space flight.
So first he was a pilot and then you were born.
And then I was born.
Yeah, in some way intimately linked. It is a sexy business.
It is, yes. Okay. Yeah. I haven't asked him about it, actually.
That's why you like flying so much.
Yeah, I love flying. So he raised me with a great interest in space flight, moon flight and the stars. And actually, he had me watching a program that he watched, a program that started in the year he was born, 1957. That's The Sky at Night, which was started by Sir Patrick Moore, the late Sir Patrick Moore, who passed away in 2012. And actually, I grew up to know Patrick very well because we lived in a town not far away from him. And so as I got older, I was really fascinated and driven by his enthusiasm, which was really infectious.
Yeah.
And then eventually I had the opportunity to make a few trips to the Southern Hemisphere as a child, family holidays and that sort of thing. And I've got to say, your listeners down there will appreciate this. The stars in the Southern Hemisphere really are spectacular. And it's the sort of thing that can really get you hooked. The weight of the Milky Way is staggering when you have it overhead. It's very uplifting at the same time. It makes you feel a bit lightheaded, like you're sort of traveling into it.
Yeah.
But when you can stand outside and read a book by the light of the stars, you suddenly recognize that the Milky Way is vast and it is your home. And that's when I knew I wanted to learn everything I could learn about it. And I ended up in the same place that Rad's in, dreaming about stargazers on other worlds, looking at our sun as a faint point of light, perhaps in their telescopes, and wondering what's happening here.
Radmila Topalovic and Tom Kurz talking to Robert Bowne there, and their book Stargazing, Beginner's Guide to Astronomy is available now.
Lauren Collins has become a favourite writer for those reading The New Yorker over the past few years, where her subjects have ranged from Michelle Obama to Donatella Versace.
But it was a move from the US to Europe that provided the inspiration to her latest work, her book, When in French. Having found love with a Frenchman, Olivier, Lauren soon realised that the nuances of the French language were something of a mystery, and her journey to become au fait, as it were. See what I've done there? With French culture forms the basis of the brilliant new book. And she joins us now to tell us a little of what she's learned. In English, though, please, Lauren. But welcome to the Monocle Weekly. You can probably tell from my botched attempts there that I'm not a speaker of any languages other than English. Is that something that, I don't know, when people read the book or when you talk to other predominantly English speakers, do they share this sense of
I don't know. It's not. Well, I feel shamed. Is there a bit of a sense of shame about our kind of singular Englishness?
Gigantic sense of shame. Right on up to the president, at least for a few more weeks, Barack Obama. I realized in writing the book, I went back to see what public figures had said about languages. And Obama in the last election actually said, you know, kind of embarrassing being an American. All these people can speak eight languages and all we can say is merci beaucoup. But yeah, writing a book about learning another language has elicited this great outpouring of kind of shame and grief and embarrassment from readers. I mean, it's great to hear that I'm not the only one who emerged from high school Spanish with a grasp of nothing but hola and gracias and crucially habla inglés. So, yeah.
And tell me, okay, when we think of any language to learn, that, you know, any new language is, of course, tricky, but French, there's something about French which is very off-putting. And there's a line in the middle of your book which really made me laugh. It summed it up so well. It says, French is not a hospitable environment in which to try your luck. It really is a language. It's rules. It's regulated. French people are very proper about their language and don't like it being abused. When you started to learn French properly, were you aware that very notion that, you know, you can have a go maybe in your local deli or something, but actually if you're going to engage in any conversation, then you're not going to get away with bad language?
Well, you can have a go maybe in your local deli, but don't even try it at your local family dinner table. I mean, I was coming from some tough critics already. At least my husband and his family, the family that I married into, you know, are under the impression that they're doing you a gigantic favor by correcting every little slip up. And honestly, it comes from a generous place. I mean, they don't want you to look like a fool out in the world. No, French people are not afraid to like wrap your knuckles every time you make a tiny little mistake. And it's actually considered a hospitable act. I mean, that's like a kind thing to do in French. So it can be a little bit mortifying to just get out there and try.
There's another interesting character, especially at the beginning of the book, which is the city of Geneva. I'm not sure if they're going to give you the keys to Geneva after this book. That was
I have not heard from the mayor yet, but I've been checking my mailbox every day.
You arrive in the city, which is closed at weekends, and there's not a huge amount to do. And certainly people don't want to kind of go out of the way to speak English to you. And you realize there is this imperative need. Plus, you, of course, have your partner. You need to change your life. That journey into learning a language, were you confident as you set off? Because, you know, you have a partner. You said you don't even know at some point whether you really understand each other, whether the things you're saying in English mean the same in French. When you set off, did you think, oh, actually, I'm the kind of person who will be able to conquer this? This is doable.
No, I thought I was exactly the kind of person who wouldn't be able to conquer it. I mean, I had, you know, I'm sure this will be absolutely shocking to the listeners of this show, but I didn't have a passport until I was 19. You know, I thought that French was a language that you basically had to be born with. It was a privilege, not a skill. And so, no, I stayed away from French out of this kind of inferiority complex. But Olivier said something to me one day which just hit me like a ton of bricks, which was talking to you in English, which he did very well, but talking to you in English feels like I'm touching you with gloves, he said to me. And I just felt like there was a part of him that I was never going to be able to access if I didn't, you know, at least give it a college try. So,
and also if you're going to have a family as well, that fear that you're going to grow up with children who will be speaking and you will not have a clue what they're up to.
Yeah, that was a major fear. I mean, I didn't want to be this kind of Borat mother, like embarrassing them and missing out on like all the playground gossip and having like 3-year-olds snickering about me behind my back. So yeah, there were a number of motivating factors.
Lauren, it's funny that you mentioned that thing about the touching with gloves, because actually in the book, there's a bit of, you've had not a row, but it's at a moment of kind of raised emotional pitch,
I guess.
Right,
you can call it a row.
It's a row, that's fine. But it's funny because reading the book, and it's a sort of a love story as well. People often say, oh, well, you know, if you don't have language, then relationships they're better, because it comes down to something much more fundamental. It's a primal thing, you know, it doesn't have but do you think that, especially with the whole experience you've gone through, that actually it does mean the building blocks, if you like, are stronger? Or do you just think it, because it's a big effort and it takes a lot of work, it's worth it in the end? Or is
well,
it a bit of
I think the kind of primal sub-linguistic theory of attraction works at the beginning, but it's not sustainable. The problem is then you get into a relationship and you start living together, and as you kindly pointed out, you do row. And the problem is that you hit these same kind of impasses in communication over and over again. And because you not only don't understand, I mean, language isn't just words, right? There's a whole set of cultural assumptions and expectations and baggage that comes along with language. And so I found that we were just finding ourselves at the same dead ends over and over again. I, coming from this American school of conflict resolution, would say things like, I want X, I need Y. And Olivier took that as evidence of my just raging narcissism. and you know, I thought that in my language and from my perspective, that was like, that was a way to try to reach harmony, but it wasn't working with him. So anyway, I figured if I couldn't see the whole picture, I was never going to figure out where it was that we stood.
So as you learn the language, and in the book you see that unfolding, the sense that you're taking on a culture or being given the keys to a culture. And by the end of the book, there's some very nice scenes which reveal how, well, do you feel you have become partly French?
Mais oui. No, but I do, of course. I mean, I really think, and you know, I'm not coming out of nowhere on this. I mean, I think most people, overwhelmingly, in fact, people who speak more than one language say that they feel like different people in different languages. There's also a scientific basis to this. I mean, we make different moral choices, for instance, in a second language, and it has to do with processing. I mentioned this in the book. People told scientists that they would be more likely to push a guy in front of a train to save five other people when posed this dilemma in their second language. And scientists hypothesized that the reason for that is that you have to think more in a second language. You're more rational. You're more logical. You're not carrying around all the emotional charges of your first language. So there are real kind of cognitive reasons that you become a little bit French when you learn the language. But there are also all kinds of other reasons. I mean, I love walking out the door and tossing around adjectives like kind of exéclable and formidable. And that's not, you know, in English, I'm identifiably kind of a nice blonde chick from the South of America. But in French, I feel a little bit, I'm a little more mysterious. And that's been kind of a liberating transformation.
I wonder about the idea of language and sort of the sort of acquisitive side of things. Would you be open to, I don't know, if work or family plans, whatever, took you to another exotic locale? Do you think would you have it in you to do it again? And you know, why not? Because I believe Olivia speaks Spanish also.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, if a relocation took you to Latin America or something like that, or do you think one is enough?
Oh, I mean, theoretically, yes. And, you know, I want to use my little moment in the pulpit here to also say, at this moment of kind of rising, you know, nationalism and xenophobia, I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about is if we could all speak another language, you have to think it would make a little bit of a difference. So yes, I urge anyone to learn a language. I mean, I think it's critical not only for the state of, you know, my marriage, but also for democracy and everybody getting along in the world. But French was blood, sweat, and tears for me. It still is. And it wiped clean. I mean, I had studied Spanish kind of half-heartedly in high school, but I can't access any of that now. So while I would like to say I'd be game for another language,
There's a finite amount of capacity in there.
Yeah.
That's my excuse. I'll forget some trivia if I actually did learn more.
Well, no, but, and also, I mean, French is like laundry. It's like I'm never done. I still feel like I'm really right in the thick of it.
And just to, you know, this book, we should point out, it's like, it's the history of the language. There's psychology in there. There's kind of numerous layers. But that process, I think me and Tom are both grasping here, wondering whether we could ever do it. But at that moment of like learning language, you say, you know, people will say, oh, God, just put on the TV. You can learn French by having French on in the background.
Yeah, you can.
And you realize it's like impossible because you can't even follow the game show.
TV is a bad idea for a number of reasons. Like, first of all, there's something called plot, which it's hard enough to turn on a TV show in English, right? If you miss the 10 episodes before and you have no idea where the show's going. I started listening to the radio very, very slowly. And I had a script that I would go along with every day. And then I started listening to the radio a little bit faster, like it was the correct day's newscast. But yeah, it's just so many steps. And you never feel like you're there.
But now when you look back on that journey, are there things that you think were key to you ending up where you've ended up? You know, was it that you were immersed in a relationship? Was it because you were in the country? Because we think about the, you know, the attributes you need to learn mm-hmm. a language as you get older, and I think it is dinged into us, you know, that if you don't do it when you're very young or at school age, at least, it becomes, you know, increasingly complicated to do. Now, you've kind of tipped over that kind of theory, and you've proved that you can do it in the right circumstances.
Well, here's, I think it all comes down to desire. I mean, for me, this became a parallel love affair to the one that I was having with the person that I met. But all your best intentions are not going to take you anywhere unless there's like a real burning reason that you decide to learn a language. And that doesn't have to be falling in love with a French man, but it can be that you want to progress in your career and you need it. It can be that you move to a country and you're never going to be able to buy a bottle of shampoo if you don't learn it. I mean, but something, I think something when you're, you know, when you reach a certain point in your life and you have so many responsibilities and so many little things taking up your headspace, you have to really want it.
And you made some nice clangers along the way. You made, you said some terrible things to your mother-in-law, to people in shops.
Right, right. Yes, that was that I had given birth to a coffee machine. I found that one out maybe 3 years after I said it. So I'm sure there are more. Just wait. You know, they'll come back to me. Yeah.
What about France and the French language though does to make itself open? Because I know again in the book you write about, I can't remember the name of it, but the Academy Française, which has these very kind of specific and rigorous standards mm-hmm. for appraising the kind of francophonizing of, you know, English words and that sort of thing. Do you think that maybe, because, I mean, Andrew already mentioned it, the French are quite conservative, small c, about their language, often with good reason, because they say clarity is everything and so on. But do you think sometimes that does French and the French language a disservice? Does it make it a bit more difficult maybe for people to pick up the language?
I think what's interesting is the French see the French language and all the culture that it embodies as this great counter force, really, in the world to what they would call the Anglophonie. Yeah. You know, they think that English-speaking countries are one large English-speaking conspiracy. So they're incredibly touchy, really, about their language. But I think the fact that they believe in, I mean, it's partially a myth, partially not, but they perpetuate this idea about the purity of the language actually makes it attractive to students. I mean, there's the idea that, you know, this isn't just a hodgepodge. It's something that you can tap into that has a specific history and a present and, if you buy into the Académie Française, a future.
Well, I think there's was there an Englishman who was relatively recently elected or voted onto that? So maybe, yeah, maybe that's outreach right there.
Exactly.
And just tell us finally, the book also charts your disappearance from Geneva and saying goodbye to the lake. You now live in...
You sound like somebody who might have spent a day or two in Geneva.
I think we even met the mayor, actually. Anyway, but you now live in Paris and you've made a home there. How much is that journey into literally the heart of the country? How significant has that been for your transformation into feeling like, you know, a French woman living a French life?
Huge, because, you know, in Geneva, it's difficult. It's such a transient population. It's maybe 50% foreign-born, and English really is the prevalent. It's the lingua franca there. But in Paris, I mean, my French skyrocketed the second I got there, probably both because I was being forced to speak French more and because I wanted to. But no, I mean, the last line of the book is we were moving to Paris, and, you know, I feel like it's my big bonus after all those tests. But I was living in French, in the language. I mean, that became a sort of psychic terrain of its own for me. But now I'm living in France and there seems to be a little bit more harmony in the place and in the thing that I speak. So,
well, it's a wonderful story and it's beautifully told in When in French, Love in a Second Language. The author is Lauren Collins. And Lauren, thank you very much for coming to tell us all about it here on The Weekly.
Thank you.
Well, there we go, Andrew. Edition 380. Bites the Dust. Another fine show.
Yeah,
we had lessons in love and language. We talked about the craziness of US politics and all the different light and shade in between.
all the guests have been amazing. The interesting thing with Lauren Collins, I think both of us are kind of sitting here thinking, oh God, perhaps we should have learnt a language. You feel a bit bad, don't you?
I do. Well, this is what I said at the start there.
I've got a smattering of the old Deutsch, which I can get.
Ein bisschen Deutsch.
Yeah, yeah. Natürlich. But I'm quite good in a restaurant setting and all that kind of stuff. I can do all the transport and all that world. But it's being able to have a kind of engaging conversation with someone in their language. I tried to learn Spanish a couple of years ago. Had to go very early in the morning before Monaco. And then it just became too impossible.
No, it's difficult. I think one of the problems in this country specifically, and I don't know if it's the same the world over, is it's taught in a very, it's still very sort of literal. So there's no emphasis on an actual conversation interaction. So like I said, I've got phrases in, for example, German. So I can ask somebody, what is the most efficient way to get to the pedestrianised area? But then they'll tell me the answer and I won't know what they've said. See, which is completely pointless.
Oh,
it's Fuskingerzone, in case you're wondering.
Okay. I got some dirty words as well, but I'm not going to.
Okay, let's wrap things up. But a fine show, Andrew, as you said, 380. Perhaps we should thank those responsible for it.
Well, let's thank Tom Hall, who's the producer.
And our studio managers, plural this week.
Yes, Andrew, we're Toby Hammond.
And Clara Barn. So good I named her twice.
And the Monocle Weekly is going to be back at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Cheerio.